Good morning and welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, partner in charge of the IBM Center for the Business of Government. We created the center in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. The Business of Government Hour features a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. Our conversation today is with Rodney Bent. Rodney's a professional staffer on the House Appropriations Committee. But perhaps more interesting, he's just come back from 6 months in Iraq, where he's been the director of the CPA's Office of Management and Budget, and also served as a senior advisor to the Iraqi Ministry of Finance. Good morning, Rodney.
Good morning.
And joining us in our conversation also from IBM is Jonathan Brule. Good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning.
Rodney, let's start at the beginning. Could you begin by describing for our listeners how the resources were allocated for the construction of Iraq, the reconstruction of Iraq?
Absolutely. There were three pots of money. Perhaps the most important pot of money is the Iraq's own resources, the oil money that it earned both currently and then previously under Saddam, under the Oil for Food program. That's about, in terms of the 2004 budget, $21 billion. In addition, there was $18.4 billion that was appropriated last year, and prior to that, a couple of billion, $3 billion that Congress also appropriated. Finally, there was the about $12, $13 billion that other countries had pledged to help Iraq in its reconstruction in a Madrid conference in October of 2003.
Now, money was allocated through the supplemental, and I'm curious, is there precedent for allocating money this way?
There is. The president requested something over $21 billion, I think, originally, and he presented his request in a format with about 10 or 11 sectors, about 60 line items such as power generation or potable water. But he really was requesting a large amount of money that would be similar, that he could use in a flexible manner, similar to what had been done with the Y2K fund or the supplemental immediately after the September 11th tragedy.
Rodney, the Coalition Provisional Authority, or CPA, was the name of the temporary governing body which has been designated by the United Nations as the lawful government of Iraq until Iraq assumes sovereignty. What role did the CPA play in managing the fund?
Oh, huge role. Ambassador Bremer was essentially the fiscal steward for the Iraqi funds, and he was also, if you will, the person who was allocating the American supplemental. What he and CPA did essentially was to try and put together a budget and a resource plan for the reconstruction of Iraq.
Well, what are the critical skills required to manage and provide oversight for the reconstruction funds?
Good question. I think that when I got out there, I discovered I had a staff of 10 or 11 people who were enthusiastic, young, intelligent, but had never worked on budget issues before. And so one of the skills, and we can talk a little bit later about this, is sort of that fundamental analytical perspective, how to listen, how to ask the right questions, what kind of options do you prepare, who's doing what? What are the consequences if you do it a certain way? Can it be done? What are the practical questions?
Well, what was your role and what were your duties then while you were in Iraq?
I had a bunch of them. I was the head of the CPA Office of Management and Budget. I was the senior advisor to the Ministry of Finance, and I was also the senior advisor to the Ministry of Planning and Development Cooperation and other duties as assigned.
How do you get three jobs?
Well, essentially, the titles were meaningless in the sense that we were sort of inventing as we went along. It wasn't structured. You went out there and you essentially would see things that needed doing, questions that needed to be asked, or problems that needed to be addressed. And so a lot of times, you know, we were working on things that would have been well outside the purview of what you would normally think of. For example, we worked on the wage structure for Iraqi civil servants. You know, who gets paid how much, how they're defined. That is not something that usually a Ministry of Finance or an OMB would look at, but there it was essential. And then you add in things like reforming the pension system or handling food subsidies, oil subsidies, electricity subsidies, building electric power plants. It was just a huge range of activities.
What does a typical day look like when you're doing these kind of things?
Well, it was intense. Generally, people were in the office by 7 in the morning, and we would go until 10, 11, midnight, 1 or 2, 7 days a week. The only time we theoretically had off were Friday mornings between about 9 and 12:30, where I say theoretically because no meetings were supposed to be held, but in fact, people tended to go to the office because that's where the computers were, that's where you could get things done. Well, it was tough.
Tell us about your experiences leading up to this role.
Sure. I had been, for 5 years prior to doing this job, the senior career head of the international division at the Office of Management and Budget, and I'd worked at OMB for about 20 years. For that, I'd been a banker in New York and had worked at the U.S. Treasury Department in their international division.
And then tell us about, given your experience, walk us through your decisions to actually go to Iraq.
Well, it was a little spontaneous. I got a call from the Pentagon asking if I knew anybody who would be interested in working on budgets in Iraq, and I said, I would. And they said, well, the search is over.
And when you got there, how would you compare and contrast your experiences sort of in Washington versus working there, and just in terms of, say management skills and the kind of things, you know, you would think about as an advisor?
There are a lot of similarities, especially given work at OMB, where usually there's a lot of conflict. Agencies want more money. The Congress wants more information. The president wants more flexibility. And some of those same conflicts played out in Iraq as well. But there were just extra complexities in Iraq. There were extra challenges. Take small things like phones. Here, everybody has got phones, faxes, email. There were no landlines in Baghdad, so everybody had to use small cellular phones. The signals were erratic. In fact, I used to have to stand on a chair at the Ministry of Finance to try and call back to CPA with the cell phone. Most people didn't have phones, and so although the CPA provided cell phones to the minister and his senior deputies, they weren't always on. You couldn't always find people. And so you just basic communication was hard. Plus, Iraq is a society that prizes that kind of personal relationship. Things that you might do here over the phone, there really required a face-to-face meeting. You had to sit down, you had to have tea, you had to talk about families, you had to talk about your personal relationship. It's a very intimate kind of way of doing business.
Well, how about just continuing down the tactical? How about just languages?
Most of the Iraqis that we dealt with were quite fluent in English, greater or lesser degree. We did have interpreters, and you'd use them in situations where it was important that you get the facts or the nuances exactly right. But by and large, we conducted business in English, and that was less of a problem than I thought it might be.
And then how about the speed of decision-making? As you were describing all the challenges in your different role, I couldn't help but think sort of a desire to go fast and get things done. And when you talked about the relationships people needed having tea, it seemed like go slow. So I'm curious about your balance.
There was clearly a lot of cultural differences, if you will. Ambassador Bremer is a very decisive guy. Anybody who's been in a meeting with him, you know, he wants the facts, he wants your recommendation, he wants to know why you think this way. He'll ask, frankly, a series of very probing questions, and he makes a decision. With the Iraqis, it's a different cultural mode of handling things. There's a great respect for, I think, elders, and so that means that when you have a conversation, you have to make sure that the oldest person in the room has a say. You have to make sure that there's a traditional or terrific emphasis on coming to consensus. It's people might say what they think, but they always want to bring in other people. And so you found yourself frequently having to make sure that you talked with everybody and that you drew people out in a way and did it in a respectful manner. It's considered very rude to directly contradict somebody. It's not that people don't say no, but they would preface it by saying, well, with respect, I appreciate what you're saying, but in fact, I must offer up an alternative suggestion as opposed to you're an idiot. And that took a little while to get used to. If you're coming from a culture that kind of prizes decisiveness and get it done and do it now, to a culture where you have to explain the context, people want to know what your motivation is, why are you doing this, what are the implications, what does it mean for them, and that it just takes more time. But in some sense, it's worth it because once they're persuaded, then they will do it.
How did all these things change your management approaches and styles while you were there?
The absolute importance of listening carefully. Before I went over, I asked a variety of people at the World Bank or AID or the State Department what it was like and what the issues were. And I think one of the best pieces of advice I got was to listen to what the Iraqis wanted, not just jump ahead and assume that they would want the same things that we would want. And so I spent, frankly, a lot of my time listening and then trying to summarize and then and trying to present options that would reflect what they wanted.
Can you give me an example of where they would not want what we wanted?
Well, yeah, a couple. In terms of basic personal security, the aftermath of the war was really a disaster. The looting, the crime, the Iraqis had this tremendous sense of personal vulnerability in which your kids could be kidnapped as they were walking to school. Cars were taken. It's impossible to project or that sense of insecurity to, say, people here in Washington. You walk out your door, you get in your car, you drive off. You don't worry about somebody taking shots at you. You don't worry about your kids being grabbed while they're being walked to school. You don't worry about a ransom note. You don't worry about roadside bombs or grenades or gunshots. And yet that's part of everyday life in Iraq. There is that huge difference there. So security is one thing. Basic infrastructure, electricity, communication, telephones, these are all things, employment, that are important to Iraqis. And yet, for the Americans, I think when we were there, and I'll just use this as an example, not to pass judgment, but security, sort of training the Iraqi police or training the Iraqi armed forces. And that clearly is part of dealing with that first problem. I talked about security, but it was such a long-term solution. It was something where, you know, by the time the police were trained and equipped, it was going to be months down the road. And yet what the Iraqis wanted now was being able to walk out their door and not feel like they were going to be killed.
Interesting. How has the economy of Iraq changed over the last 2 years? We'll ask Rodney Bent to take us through the state of the economy pre-Iraqi freedom and what it's like now when the Business of Government Hour returns.